I'm really grateful to have this honor and this privilege. I unfortunately didn't get to meet Donna until late last night, so I don't know a lot about her. I asked her this morning what she might want you to know, and she said she's a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she's just a drunk. So, you know what I know now. Looking forward to hearing the story, Donna.
Thank you. I'm Donna Watts. I am an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank the committee for inviting Sterling and I, and we have the great pleasure of having Mr. B along with us. He's the one who lit the candle last night, and y'all are in for a real treat in the morning. He's a very special man to me and my sobriety. And when somebody asks, what do you say about you, you know, I don't know of anything better than to say I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm grateful to be alive and to be able to be a part of this fellowship and this program. And you'll know me when this is over. That's all I can say. That's what I'm up here for, is to share a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, to the best of my ability and to the best of my perceptions today, because, as she said last night, my perceptions do change as I stay sober, because I learn more about me. And I'll start out by telling you that I was born just a state away in Dallas, Texas. And I always wanted to be the yellow rose of Texas, but I turned out to be the lone star. And that really has nothing to do with anything, except I started feeling inadequate from the very beginning. I am an only child, and that presented a lot of the way I developed as a child, because I didn't have any siblings to learn the normal things that most of you learned in your childhood growing up, like how to share, how to defend yourself, how to have relationships with people, how to interact, how to have some defenses, how to, you know, just all those things a lot of you all take for granted. I never learned them naturally. And I felt very inadequate, and I was just waiting on a drink to come along to help me cope with life and with everything that goes on in life. I didn't know how to deal with it because I just didn't get the practice. And the only other thing about my childhood that I feel is important to the way I developed was that there was no God in our home. God was never mentioned. After I was born, there were three stillborn boys born after me. And for somehow, like I say, I started perceiving things wrong from the very beginning, but I didn't know they were wrong. I felt guilty for being alive, number one, but I felt like somehow I needed to be all to my parents, and somehow later in life this bled over to be I needed to be all to everybody. I needed to be the good little girl so that they would be happy, you know, trying to fulfill all these shoes. And I only had two of my own. And you know, when you're trying to be a good little girl all your life, and there's a bad little girl inside, that's not an easy job to do. And so I learned people pleasing and conning and manipulation and all those things, I guess, from early on. And somewhere along the line, I learned it wasn't okay to be angry. I learned to stuff from the very beginning. I always have stuffed my feelings, trying to put on that better face for the outside and trying to please you. We moved several times, and we had moved about five times by the time I landed in Danville, Virginia, to start the seventh grade. And by this time, I was angry. I was angry about all this moving. And I was tired of not belonging to anywhere or anything or any group of people. You see, I felt so different, number one, because I was an only child and hated it. I felt so different because it seemed to me like everybody else in the world had this God that I didn't have. All my friends had gone to church all their life, and Sunday school and vacation Bible school and on, and were so comfortable with all that stuff. And I felt so different and less than, because I didn't have it. And many times I searched throughout my life for this God that it seemed to me everybody else had, and I couldn't connect. There were plenty of people that had something that could give to me, but I could not receive until I got to you people, and it took me a little while in the program. after you tore my bricks down far enough to share your God with me until I could find the God of my understanding. And I'll be forever grateful for people like you sitting in rooms like this for being so patient with me and sharing your God with me. And so I told you I was angry by the time I landed in Danville, Virginia, and I decided I was going to belong to somehow to a group of people. And I set out on that course, and over the next 6 years, you would have thought I had achieved it. If you'd have looked at me back then, you'd have said, well, there is Miss High School USA. I was into everything from cheerleading to getting honors and, you know, just everything. And it appeared that I had a lot of friends, and I did have some friends. But nothing was ever enough to fill that hole that I had on the inside. And I know today that nothing would have ever been enough. But I didn't know that there. You know, my drinking started in high school. And every time I drank, I got drunk. There was never a social drink in my life. I had a purpose because when I drank, that Donna that was on the inside could come out. And she could be anything she wanted to be. She could say anything she wanted to say. And I didn't care if you liked me or not. Because I was still trying to fill that hole on the inside. And my drinking had a lot of alcoholic characteristics from the very beginning. I would drink and feel good, you know, get that nice feeling, but I'd keep on drinking, you know, as we do. And I would go over many times into that remorseful drinking all in the same evening. And I didn't know what happened to me. You know, what happened to the feeling good? I didn't understand it. And a lot of times I would end up crying and, you know, before passing out. And I just didn't understand what happened to that period of time where it all felt so good. And I felt okay. And nothing else mattered. And that continued for the rest of my drinking days. And life wasn't wonderful, but it was the best I had created so far. And because I was in charge by this time, I thought. And I wound up going to college in Greenville, South Carolina. Now, I know here that God was looking out after me because I went to Furman University. And back in 1963, it was a very strict Southern Baptist school. Now, I don't know why I went there. I think God's hand was definitely in it because I would be telling a different story, if any story at all, if I had gone to one of the other places I was looking at. So I went down there, and I was miserable. I was totally miserable because I did a lot of drinking in high school. In fact, the word drunk appeared about 25 times in my senior high school annual when I was doing my fourth step, you know, trying to find out more about me and when my drinking started. I was miserable, and I didn't know why, you know, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And it took me 6 months to find some people who drank in that Southern Baptist school. And once I found them, then Furman got a lot better. And amongst these drinkers was my future husband. And so Furman got a little better, and he was 2 years ahead of me and graduated, so I did what everybody who watched Donna Reed, Father Knows Best, et cetera, et cetera. You get married and supposedly live happily ever after. Well, that didn't happen for me. As I told you, I didn't have all these coping skills, and when the normal things start happening in an early marriage, I didn't know how to cope, and I started out coping with my alcohol, I think, even at that early time when I was 20 years old. It had gone beyond just the partying time. I started needing it little by little, and it wasn't very long until I needed it a whole lot. One thing I'd like to tell you about the man I did choose to marry at that time, he was a very spiritual man at that time in his life. In fact, he even did some lay preaching on the weekends. And I think in my subconscious mind, I thought, well, you know, if I get close to him, maybe I can get close to this God that it still seemed that everybody had except me. Because, you see, I had gone to church on my own in high school. And to tell you where my mind was and my alcoholic pride and ego, I couldn't go to Sunday school because I tried that because, you see, all those people were too far ahead of me, and I didn't want them to know that I didn't know what they knew. I didn't know any of that stuff. And so I stayed away from that. And so here again, I was trying to search out God, I think, in a slight way with this man that I chose to marry. He became very unspiritual not too far into that marriage. but anyway, not long after that, I trained in a profession to cytotechnology to screen pap smears for cancer. And so I had a profession, so I was feeling a little better about myself. But the marriage still wasn't going good. And along came our son, who wasn't particularly planned. And I talk about total fear. An only child pregnant at a young age creates a lot of fear in an alcoholic woman. I'd never even been around babies. I was petrified. But God does look after drunks, fools, and young mothers, and I was all three, so he had a pretty good full-time job with me. Because right after my son was born began my daily drinking. I had to do it to cope. It was already mentally necessary for me to drink in order to get through the rest of the day. And also, after my son was born, when he was about three, see, the marriage was going downhill south. And here I was with this son, and I don't know whether this ever happened to you all at work, but, you know, they just didn't appreciate the good job I was doing. And if they'd only do things my way, it would go so much better. And put this along with a three-year-old and a husband that's doing all kind of things. I had to drink, and I drank myself into such a state I had to take a leave of absence from work. Now, this just gave me the opportunity to drink all day long, which was the beginning of a bad time in there. And I was 24 years old when I did this, and I knew in my heart I could not take care of a three-year-old and drink like I was doing, so I continued to take him to the nursery. And I can remember just that awful degradation and feeling when I would go to pick him up around 3 o'clock, holding my breath, not looking at anyone or talking to anyone, to go in there and pick him up because I didn't want them to smell the alcohol on my breath. I knew something was wrong with me, but I had no idea what it was. And I wound up in Marshall Pickens for a week, which is our, it's a nice mental facility in Greenville. you know, I was coming apart. I was seeing a psychiatrist. I was seeing my priest. I was trying Episcopal Church at that time. And all these things, but I couldn't cope and wound up in there for depression, of course. My drinking was never mentioned, and that place got my attention. I was scared. I wanted out of there. And so what I did was sober up and act straight, and I got out in a week. And but my drinking was never addressed. And I know today, at 24 years old, I 100% qualified for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the God of my understanding wanted me to have a little more experience to bring to you all, I guess. But like I say, my drinking was never mentioned. I would like to insert here that the year my son was born, I started seeing the chaplain at the hospital system where I worked. And he's very important because he understood alcoholics and alcoholism. And all through the next 12 years, I saw John at no regular basis, but he was always the steady person in my life. And he knew not to ever mention how much I drank until I was ready. He knew way back then I was an alcoholic, but in his wisdom, he knew not to push it. And so, a year after that, my husband and I did separate to divorce. And divorce wasn't real popular back then in 72. And so it was a real scary time for me because I felt like a failure as a woman, as a mother, as a wife, as a human being, you know. And there was only one way that I could function and cope with life. Anger fueled me. You see, I was such an angry person when I got here because all I had ever done was stuff it and drink to help cope with it. And, of course, the anger turns into all the 9,000 other defects that we have. But so much stems from that and from fear. And the only way I could cope, I was motivated by anger, and I coped with alcohol. So when I separated for divorce, I was 26 years old. I had the full responsibility of a 4-and-a-half-year-old. I had $100 to my name, and all I could say was, I'm going to show the world that my son and I can make it, and I don't need any help from anybody. And that was my attitude that I set forth with, and it just about killed me. And it would have if I had not gotten to you people. The next 10 years of the drinking single mother life took on every aspect of drinking and living that an alcoholic woman can live, or an alcoholic man, either one. I went through all the different phases, and I'd like to say here that being single was my biggest enabler, because my attitude was, I make my own money, and it's none of your business how much I drink or how often I drink. And if you had asked me, that's what I told you. But on into a few years of this, I found some drinking friends, partying friends, you know, and all this, and they started talking to me about my drinking. And to me, they drank it same as I did, but they perceived my drinking as different, and it was because of those bad times that we get into, but to me, they drank all the same time I did. But I would have the totally alone drinking. I would get down, and when my son would go to his father's on the weekend, I would start drinking as soon as I shut that door on Friday, and I wouldn't come out till Monday, just drinking, passing out, playing those old songs that we all love to cry for, and cry to, and pass out to. And then I would say, well, I'm going to fix my life, and I would decide on something and take forth on that path and try that, and I would have the party and sing. And I was very self-conscious about my behavior because of my son. You see, my son was my reason for living a lot of days. And I don't know if I would be alive today if it wasn't for him, for having to do for him. And when I can remember turning 30 years old, and I knew I would not live to 40. And that was okay with me, because all I wanted to do was to get him through high school, and then it didn't matter what happened to me. You know, I would get in those frames of mind, and it was okay. I just drank to live and live to drink. And I decided it was my job that was what was wrong with me. And I would search out different jobs, but nothing would ever gel. And you know, my life was just on a merry-go-round of all the different attitudes. And when it became sociably okay for women to go to bars, you know, there was a little period there where it became okay. And so I could go to the bar scene now. And so I did all the different kinds of drinking, and I tried all the different kinds of controlling my drinking. I never tried to quit. I think I knew deep down in my heart and my gut that I couldn't. There was no question I didn't want to, but I think I knew deep down that I couldn't. So I never did try to quit, but I tried to control and to set up all these parameters, you know, the whole nine yards that we've all tried. And even when I had surgeries, my friends would bring me alcohol to the hospital the day after the surgery, because they knew what alcohol did for me. It made me better, you know. And so that was the kind of life I was in. And then in 1979, the laboratory I was then working for changed hands. And by the when I had divorced, I had gone to work for a laboratory, and he had said, get your work done, you can leave. And so due to the circumstances at that time, I was finishing up about 2 every day. And so what does an alcoholic do when you go home? You start drinking. So it didn't take me long, when I was about 27, that alcohol was necessary by 2 o'clock every day. You know, you do that long enough, and it's necessary. And so when this new laboratory changed hands, this new pathologist had the audacity to expect me to work till 5 o'clock. And I told him I could not, with all my 19,000 good reasons why. And he said, you must. And I tried it for 2 or 3 days, and I absolutely could not work till 5 o'clock. It was a physical and mental impossibility. And so I went to him, and I said, well, you know my situation. If you'd fire me so I could collect unemployment, I'd appreciate it. And you know he did. I was like the speaker this morning. I really didn't think he would, because I was indispensable, as we all feel every once in a while when we're in one of the better modes, thinking modes. But anyway, this just gave me the opportunity to drink all day long, and fueled with all these righteous reasons and all this righteous anger and all this. But I was unemployed for 3 months, and I got a job in pharmaceutical sales. Now, if y'all can imagine that. I conned my way into that job, the alcoholic con, because you're supposed to have a college degree to get that job, and I conned him into thinking that all this experience I'd had was more than that, and got the job. And so now my life, I had arrived. I thought, you know, this has sounds good, and my life was going to get okay. So what I thought, what my frame of mind was, though, you know, Donna, you don't want to do too much the first year, so you can show some improvement the second year, and a little more the third year. So y'all know where I was at 2 o'clock every day. I was home drinking, totally justified that I was doing that company a good job. Well, things are starting to close on me after 2 years when it is time to start doing better. And during this 2 year period, in this 3 year period in this job, alcohol really started doing its number on me. The progression was really taking place. I was starting to pass out at very inopportune times, like when you're supposed to pick your son up from a field trip and you're passed out and they're beating on your door because the teacher's had to bring him home and they can't get you awake to open the door, and not picking your parents up from the airport because I was just going to have 2 glasses of wine to chill like I always had to, and I passed out. You know, it was starting to, sometimes it wouldn't take a lot and I was gone. Sometimes I could drink a gallon and never get to where I wanted to be, half a gallon. You know, the unpredictability of what alcohol would do when it went into my system was just driving me crazy. Because before, there was always some element of control. I could try something different, and it would work for a little while. But all the control was going here, and I was getting scared and paranoid, and life was getting awful, and I thought, well, you know, this company's going to find out what I'm not doing, because by this time, you know, I was needing alcohol before 2 o'clock every day, a lot of days, and I would quit totally justified if it was raining. Well, doctors don't want to see you when it's raining, so I wouldn't even go to work that day. You know, that kind of thinking was starting to enter in, and plus I was just getting much, much physically worse, too. Alcoholism was closing in on me, but I didn't know what was wrong with me. And in the spring of 1982, my ex-husband came to me. And my son had finally had to go to him about my drinking. Things were that bad. And he said to me, if you don't do something about your drinking, I will have to see about having Matt taken away from you. And I said, oh, okay. You know, that could not be. I had most of the wrong reasons why that could not be, but that would never be as long as I could stand on my own 2 feet. And so I went to my medical doctor and got a little bit honest about my drinking. I think he had some suspicions. But anyway, he says, I'll tell you what, Donna, I'll put you in the hospital. You could still do this back then. And we'll dry you out and we'll see if you're an alcoholic. So I went in drunk on a Sunday night, and I came out Thursday morning early. And I did not go into DTs, or I did not hallucinate. And he said, Donna, I don't think you're an alcoholic. I said, well, I didn't really think I was either. And so I was real proud of myself that Thursday I got out, because I had 2 glasses of wine. And that was it. You know, I was off and running the next day, because there was no control left. And I was scared. I didn't know what I was going to do. And so I went to John Smith, that chaplain at the hospital system, and I said, John, what am I going to do? And he said, well, Donna, it was finally time. He said, as I see it, you have 2 choices. You can either go to a treatment center, or you can talk to somebody from AA. And I said, well, I can't go to a treatment center. That is 100% out, because I would get fired, and I probably would have. I said, but okay, I'll talk to somebody from AA. And I had no idea what AA was. The only thing I had ever seen was Days of Wine and Roses, and that made me real uncomfortable. That's all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And so this lady met me on a Saturday. It was the middle of June. And we had lunch, and she brought me some pamphlets, and I'll be forever grateful for the free AA pamphlets that we have, because I took them home, and I read what I could in them that afternoon, and she offered to take me to a meeting that night, and I said, no, I'll meet you there. You know, we got to have that back door. But I did meet her there, and it was an open speakers meeting that night, and I know I was at the first one I was supposed to be at. I have no idea much what that speaker said, but what amazed me was her 9-year-old son was sitting out in that audience while she was saying all those things she was saying. Now, that amazed me and got my attention. I didn't understand much else. In fact, I'll tell you the frame of mind I was in. I went to 4 meetings with that lady that week, Saturday through Tuesday. And when I was meeting her that Sunday, I'll tell you what I asked her, because I'll tell you what I was doing. I was not drinking, but I had this bottle of amaretto, and I had a jigger, and I would pour the amaretto in the jigger, and I would stick my tongue in it, and I was not drinking. And I asked her that going into that meeting that Sunday night if that counted. And she said, yes, it did. And I tell you, I killed a whole bottle that weekend that way. So you can imagine what I was comprehending those 4 meetings. But somebody made sure I came home with this big book. And I'll be forever grateful for that. Because I had a business meeting that Wednesday, and I had to drink to get through that thing. And it was necessary. I was coming unglued. And I drank for 6 more weeks. But while I was drinking, I was reading in this book. I don't know what I heard, or something tickled my fancy at these meetings. You know, something clicked, and I was reading a sentence at a time. I probably read a sentence 3 or 4 times. You know, wine and words don't do too good. But something was in, I couldn't deny what I was reading. Something was happening on my insides. And I knew I probably belonged back at those meetings, but I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. I just really could not. Because I had been drinking since I was 20 years old, probably on a daily basis, and I was 37 at this point. It was more important to me than food, and as important as air. It was my coping tool. And the thought of not drinking, I didn't know if I wanted to live if I couldn't drink. Didn't know if I could, didn't know if I wanted to. So this was the dilemma I was in, and I drank for 6 weeks like that. And it comes to the end of July, and I'm taking my son over to his father's on a Sunday morning. I'm already drinking, of course. And I say to myself, he truly would be better off with his father than with somebody like me, in the way I was feeling. And to me, that was given up. And the rest of that day is a total blackout. It was reconstructed by a friend of mine. And it was just one of those ugly days that I think we're blessed by being blacked out. And those that have to suffer through it otherwise are the ones who have to really remember it and experience those ugly days. But that's the kind of day it was. And I got up the next morning, and I was due in Greenwood, which is about 50 miles away, to make my paperwork come out right. You got to make your paperwork come out right. When you're in sales, make them think you're working. And so I went by my psychiatrist's office on the way to Greenwood, and he said, Donna, you're reeking of alcohol. You know, it was coming out of my pores. I made it down there by 5 o'clock that afternoon. That's the kind of day it was. It was a bad day. And I went to the grocery store and got me a bottle of wine and took it back to the room. And I started drinking it, and that awful time came for me. I'm grateful for it today, but it was an awful time at that time, and alcohol was doing nothing for me, doing nothing to me, and I knew something was going to be different. I didn't know what. I didn't know what I was going to do. Like I said, I just couldn't imagine not drinking. So I made it back to Greenville the next day. And I called that John Smith. I said, John, what am I going to do? I told him, you know, and he says, Donna, you must go to a meeting tonight. And I said, I can't. And he said, you must. And so I did go on that Tuesday night, but I could not pick up a white chip, that desire chip. I just could not make that decision. I really did not know what I was going to do. But on the next night, Wednesday, July 28, 1982, I did pick up that white chip and made that commitment, and have not found it necessary to take a drink since then. But it was not a piece of cake for me, let me tell you, because as I told you, I was doing this to keep my son. I was doing this because everybody was on my back. I was doing this not to quit drinking, but to just let everybody calm down. And then we'd see what we were going to do. That's how I entered these doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I went to meetings. That's the only right thing I did. My first 30 days is just a blur. I did not drink, but it was a blur. And I'm sure I heard enough in these meetings. But it was mainly just the pure grace of God that I did not drink, because I knew nothing about alcoholism. I could not understand what y'all were talking about on the program or alcoholism. It just, you know, I just, nothing could get through that fog very well. And so I kept on until I could hear a little bit. And I was afraid I was going to drink. And so I stayed around sober people. We have a very good Alano club in Greenville. And I just stayed there. I was paralyzed. I couldn't work some days. And I just stayed around sober people all day because home was my enemy. I didn't want to go home because I was afraid I would drink. And then I did a lot of things wrong. Like, I kept hearing this sponsor thing, you know, and I was gathering what it meant. But in Greenville, when I came in 1982, there weren't over 10 sober women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there certainly was no single-parent professional woman that would understand me. And so I obviously just couldn't find one. Y'all appointed one at some point in time, and I would have died before I called her. Y'all were reaching out to me, but the walls were so thick, nothing could penetrate. I've heard a lot of people say they felt instantly at home when they walked in AA. That didn't happen for me because my walls were so thick. That y'all were trying to love me, and oh, y'all were, you know, all the love was there pouring on me, but I was keeping you just like this. I was like a stiff board when you tried to hug me. I couldn't talk to anybody. And I'm grateful to that today because I couldn't say anything, and therefore I could listen. And listen I did, and I'm real glad for that right now, because it allowed me to absorb maybe a little bit faster, just meeting by meeting and paragraph by paragraph in this book. And I try to be patient with newcomers today and try not to overload them with too much, because I know how it was for me. I couldn't comprehend much. And so learning about this disease is slow when you just come in off the street. And here you are, and all these strange things are being said. All these feelings are all over you, and you don't know what to do with them because your coping mechanism is gone. And they get very intense. And so, you know, I was just stark, raving, gibbering idiot there for a little while. But y'all were patient with me. And I did something else wrong. I got involved with this guy, and he had the same amount of time I did. And several of you all told me that why you shouldn't do this, but this was different. And of course, you know how we are. But the main thing is, you know, I truly believe that we all get a grace period when we get here. It's a different amount of time for each of us because we all get here so differently and our circumstances are differently. But I believe God gives us each a grace period where he just purely keeps us sober without a drink until we can come to that crossroads of commitment and total surrender. And for me, this is how mine happened. Thanksgiving of that year, this guy got drunk, and that was my turning point in AA. It was like the walls went down. I wanted what you all had. It all finally made sense to me. Everything I had heard, everything I had read, I could feel it,
and I wanted what you had, and I made that turning point, and I was willing to go to any length to get it. And it really was my turning point, and let me put a P.S. here. That guy did get sober in 2 more weeks, and he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. But he was the one that made alcoholism real for me, because I knew then, seeing him and what it did to him in a short period of time, that I had this disease and that I would die if I drank again. And I finally had, I wanted to live sober more than I wanted to drink. Because see, up until probably 4 months or maybe even this period of time, I had still been carrying that bottle of wine around in my trunk. You know, I was checking this thing out, letting everybody calm down. And there was still that option in the back of my mind, well, if this doesn't work or if it gets bad enough, I can still drink. But at that point, at that turning point, that option was removed from me, and I knew that it was no longer an option, no matter what happened in my life, to take a drink of alcohol that would justify it. Now, this still didn't make it any easier, because now here came this God part that I'd been hearing all about, and I became really afraid that I couldn't get it now that I wanted it. Here was that God thing one more time. Everybody else had it, and I didn't. But here again, it's a slow process, and the hole started slowly being filled up. And I can identify for me, when I first felt that in the pit of my stomach, that little thing that was there that had not been there before. And I had just finished my 4-step. I was around 9 months sober. I was not one of these quick studies. And I balked at everything that the book says we balk at. I balked at all of them. But when the willingness was there, you get past the balking. At least I did. And I had finished my 4-step. I was in Hendersonville, North Carolina. And it was my home group night, and I wanted to be in my home group that night. And flying down that mountain is when I first knew that everything was going to be all right, and there was not one circumstance in my life that had changed. Nothing on the outside had changed. But that little feeling on the inside was finally there. And from that little seed, like the book, the flimsy reed, like the book describes, is where my faith could finally would start right there with that belief and that knowing that God had touched me on the inside and that I could maybe get this thing that you all had. And so things, you know, with sponsors and working and doing things, you know, things start getting better. And I got my blue chip and rocking along. And when I was about 18 months sober, my son came to me, and he and his daddy had been talking. My son was now 16. He was 14 when I got sober. And he wanted to know what I thought about if he went and lived the last 2 years of his high school years with his father. And my first reaction on the inside was, mm-mm, but y'all told me to ignore that one, and I did. And I started praying and really searching for what God's will might be in this area. Because, you see, my son had never really had a relationship with his father due to his father. And if I had not done what you all taught me to do with the 4-step and the resentments and the, you know, getting rid of all that garbage, I could not have really prayed for God's will and come up with what I did and that it would be okay for him to go and live with his father so that my son could be a complete whole person and know his father's love too, because he knew I loved him. But he needed to be a complete rounded person. And that's just a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, because this went against, you know, I was going to miss him, but I was doing something unselfish, probably for the first time in my whole life. And I knew, I felt okay about it, because I knew it was God's will. That didn't mean I didn't cry about it, that it wasn't painful, and that there weren't some hard times with it. I don't mean that. I just mean it was okay. Just that peaceful feeling. This is what should be. And so that was my second time of letting go and letting God. And I didn't realize that's the same process I was doing that I had with my alcohol. You know, I had let go and let God have my alcoholism. And yet nothing else to that extent had happened until this came along. And I didn't realize I was going through that same gut-wrenching process and let God have it, and it's okay. And I've done those two things and a couple more since then, but there's a distinction for me in my program today in letting go and letting God. If I let Him have it, there are grave consequences if I take it back. Now, there's a lot of things on a daily basis I turn over to God, and I snatch them back and play with them and turn them back over. And you know how we can do, occupy hours doing that. But that's different than letting go and letting God for me. And that's just the way I have to do it for me. And so then Sterling and I had developed a relationship, and we talked about getting married, and I'd been single for a long time, so I did a lot of praying over this, and we decided to, and we have a great marriage today, and I attribute it all to Alcoholics Anonymous and these principles and all y'all have taught us, because we can have a relationship because our sobriety is first and God is in the middle of our marriage. There's a lot of people come in the program in Greenville and don't even know we're husband and wife for 6 months down the road, because when we hit an AA meeting, we're each there for our own sobriety. And we're at different ages in sobriety. He's at 26 years and I'm at 17, and we have to do different things to grow, and we can allow each other to go and do what they need to do to grow in this program so that we can be whole people to bring into this marriage. So we have two wholes in a marriage, not two halves. Because two halves do not make a whole in a marriage, in our opinion. But we can have a relationship without the jealousy, the anger, all those petty defects that interfered with any relationship I ever tried to have in the past. And it doesn't just apply to husband and wife. I believe it's job-oriented, children-oriented, friend-oriented. It allows us to have relationships, these 12 steps with all the principles in them. And I wondered what I was going to do. Here I am. I got to retire when I married him. And I had never not worked. So this was a little scary for me. I had never not worked. And here my son was gone to live with his daddy. I said, what am I going to do? Well, God took care of that. All these women, all of a sudden, in Greenville, South Carolina, just started coming in. I mean, we had about 20 come in within 6 month period. And so things got really active and interesting at that point. And I learned how to share of myself and what I had learned up to that point with others. And I only knew what to do because y'all told me what to do. I'd had 2 years' experience, and that's what I could share, you know, is what had happened to me. And I was willing. So sponsoring people has been I've learned more about myself than any other. And the, you know, I did not realize how selfish I was with my time. And a lot of that came from being an only child. A lot of it came from being an alcoholic. You know, I did not realize how selfish I was with my time. But sponsoring people will take care of that real quick, because their crises do not happen on my timetable. And because people had loved me and taken time with me, I had to do the same. And so that's how we learn, is how we're treated. It's funny how God just cuts you off when it's time. He did for me. So I will close with what y'all have taught me to do, and that's to learn from my experiences and to share them to the best of my ability. And what I'm about to tell you is not about a person, but to me it illustrates what Alcoholics Anonymous is and can be if it isn't this for you yet. And I'll illustrate it through a story that happened to me. When I was 2 years sober, this girl named woman named Norma Rose asked me to sponsor her. And now Norma Rose, y'all have just met me. Now Norma Rose was a big, loud woman. And she would just soon hit you as look at you. And she was a tavern drinker, and she just, you know, was loud. And she had come in through the back door because she had a drunk husband, and she had gotten him to meetings. And, you know, she came to me one day and she said, you know, I think I may be an alcoholic. Would you help me? And I said, well, Norma Rose, I've never sponsored anybody, but I'll be glad to try. And, you know, I do believe God is in charge of who works with who, because
the bond that she and I formed is unbelievable, and it happens with everybody in this program. The bonds we form are just so strong, even though we can be completely opposite looking on the outside. Our insides are definitely the same. As was mentioned last night, we are just so alike on the insides. And so we started on this journey of recovery together, and she hated her life. Now, I hear a lot of people whine when they come in, and I probably whined my share. I mean, I know I did. But now, Norma Rose had an alcoholic husband who was trying to get sober. She had an alcoholic daughter who was trying to get sober, and an alcoholic son-in-law who was trying to get sober. And so all of these things were interacting in her life as she was trying to get sober. And she hated her job. She was a sewing machine operator. She wanted to do something else. So she worked two jobs, and she went to Greenville Tech and got an associate, two-year associate degree. And she was on her way to her new job of an apartment manager complex at 2.5 years sober. All these things had happened in a short period of 2.5 years because she worked for him. And she was killed in an automobile accident that morning. And I got the call about 8:30 that morning, and I was on the way to the hospital. And I did what you all had taught me to do. I prayed to God for the power and strength to do whatever was next. I never asked why, because y'all had drilled in my head, don't ever ask God why. That's not what you pray to God for. And so I prayed for power and strength to do whatever was next, because I had never been involved in a death in my life. When we got there, she had died instantly, and the husband had not died instantly. But anyway, I was so close to the family, and they wanted me to be a part of picking the casket out and planning the service. And so we did. And I was so exhausted by the time it was my home group meeting night. And I knew I had to go to my home group. As exhausted mentally and physically as I was, I had to go for me. And I went that night, and one of my friends was celebrating his birthday, and he asked me to read how it works, and I said, I don't think I can, Mike. I just don't think I can. And I did, and you know, that's exactly what I needed to do. That was God giving me the strength I needed to get everything into perspective by reading how it works at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The funeral was an AA funeral. Everybody from the preacher to the person who sang, who played the piano, even to the person who actually physically dug the grave, were a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. All of the pallbearers, we had everything from a man who had been in prison for 27 years to a millionaire to a black guy to a Jewish man, you know, people who normally would never meet, much less mix, all sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that when we had that funeral, there was standing room only, and there was probably 300 people in that, if we had it where our home group meets. And, you know, when you think about it, Norma Rose had been sober 2.5 short years. And here are all these people whose lives she had touched and whose lives had touched her in such a manner in a short period of time, who, if she had died 2.5 years earlier, there probably would not have been 5 people at her funeral because of the way we push people away and run them away until there's really nobody. 2.5 short years is not very long a period of time for such bonds to form and to touch so many lives. I don't think we really realize how many lives we each touch in our sobriety as we go along and go to meetings. It's just amazing when you really stop and think about it. And the night before at the funeral home, there was even more people because more people could come because it was not during working hours. And I overheard the funeral director saying, who in the world was this woman to have all these people? And this is the funeral home in Greenville, South Carolina. And, you know, I was thinking about it some time past, as you all taught me to do, trying to learn from my experience. And do you know who Norma Rose was? She was a sober, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, doing the best she could on a daily basis with the help of the God of her understanding. And I don't know about you, but I can't ask for any more. Thank you.